Welcome to the e-lecture, in which we will look at school leadership and the importance of the instructional core. My name is Catherine Merseth. Before we begin, I want to put some context around this presentation. I am a teacher educator. I am an individual who works in schools and with governmental agencies who worry about the education of children and the learning in classrooms. Therefore, I take to heart the quote that was written in the McKinsey report that said, "The quality of an education system cannot exceed the quality of its teachers." The purposes of this module are to examine effective school leadership strategies and actions focused on improving the instructional core, which I'll explain in a minute. The second purpose of this module is to explore approaches to establish a productive school and organizational culture and to prepare for the challenges inherent in trying to change those cultures. First, I want to start with the classroom, and I want to talk a bit about the observational framework, and in particular, something we call the instructional core. The instructional core has three aspects to it. First, the teacher, second, the student, and third, the content. And these three ideas work together in a triangle that is very interactive and very dynamic, and truly is where the learning and the result of the hard work of the teachers and the students and those who write the curriculum comes to fruition. The instructional core has several principles. The first one is that increases in student learning occur only as a consequence of improvements in either the level of the content, what's being taught to the children, the skill and the knowledge of the teachers and how they do this, and finally, whether students are engaged. Are they paying attention? Are they involved? A second principle of the instructional core is that if you change one element of the instructional core, you have to change the other two. It's almost as if they were in a dynamic triangle, and if we tweak on one side, we will then necessarily affect the other side. So if we change what teachers teach, they'll have to teach differently. If we change how students are engaged, the teacher or the content might need to change. So how do I know what the instructional core really looks like? Well, I want to talk to you and I want to share with you some tools for how you can focus in on the instructional core. And let me ask you first, just to take a moment and to think to yourself, what do you do when you observe a colleague, a teacher in a school? What do you look at? What do you focus on? And I'd like to just take a moment, a few seconds here, for you to think about the aspects that you try to observe when you walk into a school or into a classroom. So perhaps some of you put together an idea. I look to see if the children are seated. Or others of you said, I want to know whether the teacher is delivering accurate content. And perhaps some others of you said that you were interested to know whether the teacher used multiple modalities, multiple ways of interacting with the students. Well, one very powerful way, point of observation, is to look at the students. Often when I used to look in classrooms, I always sat and looked at the teacher. But in fact, that's not where I really should focus my energy. My energy is at the students, because after all, we are measuring students and their achievement to determine how well we are doing. And so one very specific place to look is to look at what we call the instructional task. And let me define that for you so you know exactly what that looks like. Looking at the task is important because the task, what we ask students to do in the classroom, directly predicts the performance. And also, the real accountability in the system is in the tasks that students are asked to do. A task is an actual classroom activity that students are asked to do. For example, are they asked to practice their multiplication facts? Are they asked to draw a picture of a particular event that they've observed? Are they asked to read a textbook? All of these are tasks that teachers ask students to do. Once we've focused in on what the students are doing, we need a way to measure it. And one way to measure it is to think about the cognitive demand. How hard is this for the students? Is it a memory recall kind of a question? Or is it something where they have to think, where they have to worry, where they have to talk to a colleague? Is it an evaluation? Do we ask them, how good is this? How bad is this? This is what we call the cognitive demand. And one way to think about the cognitive demand you may have heard of is by using a taxonomy that's called Bloom's taxonomy. And Bloom's taxonomy is a way to categorize thinking demands or thinking skills in classrooms, in individuals, in any of us in everyday life. And so Bloom's taxonomy is a hierarchical system of ordering thinking skills. The levels go from low to high, and with higher levels including all of the cognitive skills from the lower levels. To review these levels, just to give you a sense of what they are like, the first lowest level is called knowledge. And these are previously learned materials. They are definitions, they're concepts, they're principles. In mathematics, which happens to be my field of specialty, they're formulas. So I might ask you, what is the area, what is the formula for the area of a circle? The next level that demands a little more thinking on my part and not just recall is comprehension. It's understanding the meaning of the remembered material, usually demonstrated by explaining in one's own words. So tell me what those symbols mean in the definition or the formula for the area of a circle. The third level, again, higher level, is application. Using information in a new context to solve a problem, to answer a question, or to perform another task. So I may ask you a question about pizza, and which one is the better buy. This would be applying the formula for the area of a circle. The fourth level is analysis. And analysis means breaking a piece of the material into its parts and beginning to pull it apart and think about the relationship between the parts. So if I continue with my analogy about the circle, I can say if I double the size of the radius, what's the impact on the area? Well, then I need to think about how do these formulas and these words and these symbols all work together. The next level is synthesis, which is putting the parts together to form a new whole, to make a new idea, a new pattern, or a structure. And the last one is evaluation. And all put together, we have what's called, often presented in a triangle, and this is Bloom's taxonomy, which starts with comprehension and knowledge at the low level, application at the next level, synthesis and analysis, and then followed by evaluation. And any task in the classroom can be categorized by one of these levels. So try these. I'm going to give you a couple of examples to think about for a minute. And let me know, or you say to your colleagues or share with each other, and we'll have a chance to discuss this, what level do you think these tasks are? The first task is find how many tens are there in 4,123. The next task would be to ask, what numeral is in the tens place in 4,123. Another kind of task would be, what is 9 times 9? Or finally, a last task to categorize is, what is 1/2 plus 1/3? So let's stop for a moment and you look at these tasks, and I will briefly review how, in my mind, they fit in the level of cognitive demand. So the first task that I showed you was, how many tens are there in 4,123? And this is a bit of a sneaky question, because the answer is not 2, the answer is not 12, the answer is 412 tens are in 4,123. That took some understanding on my part of place value. So I would put that task up at comprehension and perhaps a little bit of analysis. It's a high-level cognitive task. In contrast to the next task, where I asked you, what numeral is in the tens place? Well, that's basically some memory. You remember that there's the ones, the tens, the hundreds, and the thousands. And the numeral that's in the tens place is 2. So I needed to know something about place value, so it's more at the level of comprehension. The next one is, what is 9 times 9? That's absolute basic memory recall. I don't have to even know what it means. I can just come forth with an idea, with an answer, and answer it to be 81. The last one, 1/2 + 1/3, which of course you probably know is a very challenging task for many, many students, is a much higher level cognitive demand. I need to bring together my knowledge about fractions, about addition, about how these fractions combine. I may even apply it in a new situation. So that is up much more higher in the level of cognitive demand. So when I go into classrooms, I focus on what the teacher is asking the students to do. And I look at that task and I say, is it low level? Is it mid level? Is it high level? And this is not to say that everything that a teacher do must be at the high level. But often we found that many classroom teachers tend to be at the memory recall level. And if we only ask students to recall and not apply and not synthesize and not evaluate, they are fundamentally not really learning the material in the way that we want. Now, another area that we can look at when we go into classrooms is the questions that the teachers ask. It's a very simple thing to record on your notes when you're in a classroom. Write down exactly what the teacher asks, because this too drives the kind of learning that students. Teachers often ask or can ask why questions. Why does this happen? What's the cause? What's the effect, the analysis? They can also ask questions like how. It's often the basis of problem solving and synthesis, and these are at the upper level of the cognitive demand. We can ask students which one do you prefer, which one, and it requires selection and decision making. Finally, though, sadly, many, many questions that are asked in classrooms are low level recall that ask the questions, what is the capital of France? What is the capital of England? Where is the central government? And they ask when questions. When did the French Revolution occur? And so you can see that these are much less demanding. And therefore, if we don't demand higher level thinking from our students, they won't be able to think for themselves when they leave our schools and our education systems. Teachers must ask questions that demand higher level cognitive processing, asking students to think, not memorize, asking students open-ended questions, asking indeed the students to propose their own questions. This is a very powerful way to engage learners in the classroom. Another element of questioning in classrooms that's very easy to observe for and extremely powerful is wait time. Teachers often wait less than 2 seconds for an answer. They ask a question, 2 seconds, and they call on someone. We know from very, very good and strong research that the longer you wait, if you even double your wait time to 4 seconds, you will increase the cognitive engagement of the students in the classroom. In addition, if you wait, you find that the students increase their cognitive level of response. The length of the student response will increase. The number of unsolicited responses, if you give some space in the classroom for the students to think, there are more ideas that come out. And there is more student-to-student interaction, which is something that we think is very powerful in classrooms. And finally, if you wait, and you may not believe this, but it is indeed true, the number of student disruptions will go down. And you will be able to see students engaged and teachers engaged in thinking in their classrooms. So in this section of the EE lecture, I want to explore approaches to establish a productive school and organizational culture to prepare for challenges that you will face in your organizations and in your schools. Culture is an odd term, actually. It's one that we really don't define terribly well, but I like to use a definition that was proposed by an organizational behaviorist at MIT. His name was Edgar Schein, and he said that the deeper level of basic assumptions, culture is the deeper level of basic assumptions and beliefs that are shared by members of an organization that operate unconsciously and that define in a basic, taken-for-granted fashion the organization's view of itself and its environment. There are assumptions and beliefs that are learned responses in an organization. It's just the way we do things around here, okay? And the group who works in this organization, whether it's a school or a ministry or wherever, an NGO, the group uses these techniques and this sometimes unwritten, not articulated culture to do their work. And so, in a very insidious, important way, we want to think back to what is the culture of this organization and how do we change it and how do we make it a powerful learning community, a powerful, effective organization. And so one thing that you need to be able to do is first to expose these unmentioned, these unarticulated views of how we do business here, and to talk about them, and then try to change them. And I want to caution you right now that everything that you try may not work. But if we never try, we know it won't change. But if we do try, slowly but surely, incrementally, I think you'll be able to see some progress. So let me stop again for a moment and ask you to think about the organization in which you work, whether it's a school or a ministry or another education system, and write down three words or phrases that describe the culture of your organization. Just a word or two or three words. Take a moment and write down what you believe describes your organization. Second, I'd like you to offer two or three assumptions about how you work in this organization. And then finally, I'd like you to think and write down what are the values, both explicit and implicit, that ground this culture. Now that you've had a chance to think about your own culture, let me possibly suggest some things that you may have said. You may have said, this is a warm, supportive, engaging culture. Or some of you may have said, this is not a friendly culture. This is a culture of competition. This is a culture that does not collaborate. This is a culture where individuals, it's very hierarchical, and I only talk to the person who is above me or below me, but I don't talk to the people that are across from me. Assumptions that may be underlying some of your organizations may be efficiency. Everything we do has to do with making work more efficient. And a value might be that we really value attending to the standards, attending to the requirements of the ministry, or some others of you may say what we really value are children and children's learning. So we will talk about this when we come together in our discussion session later after this e-lecture to really get down into what does the culture look like. Now, why should I make such a big deal about culture? Cultures are everything. Everything you do swims and lives and breathes and dies in this soup or this marinade of culture. They tend to conserve what is. They can be shared explicitly or implicitly by a host of stakeholders. They're sometimes fragmented. Some set of people may think this is their culture. Another set of group may think this is their culture. And they're also very difficult to change because people, human beings, even myself included, tend to resist change. So why should we focus on school and organizational culture? It's because cultures affect the behavior and the achievement of both students and employees. They don't fall from the sky. They can be manipulated. They can be changed. They can be moved toward the positive. Also, cultures are unique. Every one of you is sitting in a very different culture in your organization or in your school. And they can become, the culture can become the cohesion that bonds the school and the organization together as it goes about its work. But one important thing to remember, cultural change is a process, not a noun. So I want to pause on that just for a moment and say it again. Cultural change and changing the culture of your organization, it's a process. It's not a done noun. It's not a firm thing that's done once. So how do I change my culture? Well, first you have to decide what it is. You have to take a really long, hard, cold look at your organization and try to decide what the culture is. But what are some steps that I could use in leading change and changing culture? I'm going to walk you through 8 steps, and I've also asked you to do a reading about changing culture and leading change from a professor at the Harvard Business School, John Cotter. But I'm going to talk about it here, and then you will see this in your readings. The first step is the most important. Isn't that always true and for all of us? And it is the following. You need to build urgency for the change. And keep in mind this wonderful statement that someone told to me that I keep on my desk, which is, you will never change what you are willing to tolerate. So we need to build some urgency, and we need to not be tolerant of cultures that we think are not being productive. So what are some topics around which you could develop a sense of shared urgency in your organization? Well, in the schools, you could look at student outcomes. Are they as high and as good as you'd like them to be? What about graduation rates? Are children leaving your schools before you want them to leave? And are they leaving with skills that will enable them to hold down strong jobs? Is there corruption in the bureaucracy? Are these some things that you could build a sense of people saying, that's not right, I want to change it? In the government ministries, you might find a shortage of qualified human capital. Are you able to find the right people for the right job at the right time when you need them? Or, as true for all of us, are you facing a lack of funding? All of these topics that I've offered you as an example are areas in which you might, given your situation, be able to build a sense of urgency and a need for change. The second step is to form, then, a guiding coalition. Assess who could contribute to the change, whose voice is respected, who might be a detractor and someone who might not really help you in your particular efforts to change the culture. The third step is to create and communicate a vision and to empower others. What is your vision? How do you communicate it? Who participates in the determination of a vision? If we don't know what you as a leader think and what you want, we'll never get there. So you need to articulate to yourself and with your closest advisors, what is your vision? And then you need to communicate it. And we know from studies of leaders, of effective leaders, my colleague here, Howard Gardner, talks a lot in his book called Leading Minds about the ways that leaders communicate their vision. At every opportunity, they articulate what they believe and where the organization is going. The next several steps are to consolidate any improvements that you have been able to garner in your organization, to celebrate short-term wins. We often don't take time to say, well, we've made some progress. We should celebrate that. It's really exciting. we've got more to do, but to, as a leader, celebrate what your individuals who are working with you do. This in turn will produce more change, and it will then institutionalize new approaches, and we start the process over again. So these are the 8 steps that John Cotter articulates in his article that I've asked you to look at, and we will have a chance to talk about. But you know what? Changing culture is not easy. It's hard work. And in your experience, I want you to think for a moment, why do people resist changing culture? Why do people resist change? Well, again, drawing on my math background, I'll give you a little equation, and it's the following one. Change equals loss. C equals L. People, human beings, don't like to lose anything, good or bad. If I lose my purse, if gentlemen lose their wallets, if I can't find my eyeglasses, even if I've lost my teeth, I resist it. I don't like it. And so any change, even a change of something that I know is probably not healthy, probably not good, probably not working, I'd rather not change it. So the first real level of resistance to any kind of a change that you try to implement, anything that you've learned in this seminar, realize that people will resist it. The second reason that people resist change is that the costs are seen to be greater than the benefits. It's going to cost me more. It's going to be harder. It's whatever I get at the end, it's not going to be better. So I think that the costs exceed the benefits. Other reasons that individuals resist change, and you should keep this in mind when you're acting as a leader, as we want you to do, is they fear change. They're afraid. They don't know. They also can say to you, it's just too hard. No, I don't want to change. It's just too hard. Or quietly, and perhaps not even telling you, they don't agree with the change. And so quietly, they just kind of keep their mouths shut and they say, no, I'm not going to do that. They also might feel no ownership of the change. And so if I don't have any buy-in, any ownership, I'm certainly not going to be willing to change. So individuals wonder, what's in it for me? Okay, why should I do this? You need, as a leader, to be able to tell people why this is important. And perhaps the most important resistance factor is that people don't know how. And you as a leader need to show people, to demonstrate, to support, to cajole, to give them techniques, to talk to them about how hard this change process might be, but also to make it very clear it's non-negotiable. You are going to lead change for the better in your organization. So what are the takeaways from our lessons today? Well, one is to be able to talk about what you do in classrooms. I want you to be able to go into classrooms, observe teachers and students, and ask yourself, what is the student doing? What is the student being asked to do? I also want you to be able to observe a teacher and to notice the level of cognitive demand that the students are being asked. If we don't challenge students, they won't learn in the way we want them to learn. The second part of our lesson today was really to explore techniques and approaches to be a leader, to be a leader of change in your organization and in your school or wherever you are working on behalf of children. The most important thing to keep in mind is that children are our future. Everything you do should be in the service of children's learning. And so in building my urgency for you and for us all together in this endeavor, I say, don't forget the kids. Thank you. So in closing, I want very much to thank you for your attention and for the work that you do, because it is so terrifically important to everyone's future. Thank you very much.